Star. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the February 23rd, 2024 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is a restaurant scene. Might be a ballroom or something like that. In the foreground, sitting at a table by himself, is a huge rendition of the Russian bear. He's got a knife and fork standing up on the table in his paws. He's licking his chops. There's a glass of wine on the table. His waiter is none other than Donald Trump, dressed in a waiter's tuxedo. He's leaning over the table, and he's offering the bear a big slab of raw steak. It's got little flags of Ukraine and NATO in it. And the headline is, Serving Up Europe. Trump's threat to, quote, encourage a Russian attack on NATO allies. That is part of our first main story, and we'll start right there. Ukraine aid bill hits GOP roadblock in House. What happened? The Senate passed a $95 billion bill with aid for Ukraine and Israel this week, but it faced steep odds in the House, where hardline Republicans loyal to former President Donald Trump vowed to block the legislation. After an all-night filibuster by GOP opponents, 22 Republican senators joined most Democrats in backing the bill, which earmarks $60 billion for Ukraine, $14 billion for Israel, and $9 billion for humanitarian aid in Gaza and elsewhere. But House Speaker Mike Johnson said he wouldn't bring it up for a vote because it lacked border security measures, even though last week he helped kill a bipartisan Senate bill that paired foreign aid with tougher immigration policies. Some GOP hardliners said they'll try to remove Johnson if he allows a vote on the Ukraine-Israel bill. Trump has opposed the deal, saying the aid should be structured as a loan. President Biden warned that opponents of the bill are playing into Putin's hands and condemned Trump as un-American over his threat to not come to the defense of NATO allies attacked by Russia. At a rally in South Carolina last week, the likely GOP presidential nominee recounted telling the leader of NATO country that he would encourage Russia to do whatever the hell they want to alliance members that are delinquent in their military spending. NATO guidelines call for member nations to spend at least 2% of their gross domestic product on defense. His words set off shockwaves across the U.S. and Europe, with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg saying they put American and European soldiers at increased risk of Russian aggression. Many Republicans downplayed the comments. Give me a break, said Senator Lindsey Graham. I mean, it's Trump. What the editorial said. Trump's threat was music to Putin's ears, said the Wall Street Journal. A charitable interpretation is that they extend his previous boast that he forced many NATO countries to boost their defense spending. NATO says 18 of 31 member nations will meet the 2% target this year, up from 2 when Trump took office. But this isn't 2020 anymore. Russia has invaded Ukraine, bombed its cities and civilians, and mused about using nuclear weapons. Trump's isolationist taunt will sow doubt in the minds of our allies, and might encourage Putin to think he could get away with another invasion. Enough stalling, said the New York Post. Get aid to Ukraine. Its outgunned and outmanned soldiers need immediate relief. With Putin eyeing NATO's eastern flank, abandoning Kyiv now means disaster for Europe and chaos for the entire world. There are enough votes in the House to pass an aid bill, and sane Republicans and Democrats must put country before party and move it across the finish line. History is at a hinge here. Squabbling and stubbornness must not prevail. What the columnists said. Democrats may attempt an end run around Johnson using an obscure procedural tool called a discharge petition, said Mike Lillis and Michael Schnell in The Hill. Last used successfully a decade ago, the arduous maneuver allows a House majority of 218 to force a floor vote over a speaker's objections. But the road ahead is steep. Some progressive Democrats who oppose Israel aid won't sign it, so numerous Republicans must, and it's not clear any are willing to buck Johnson or Trump to do it. I wish Johnson and other MAGA obstructionists would visit Ukraine as I just did, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. I marveled at the bravery and resilience of Ukrainians locked in an existential struggle against a barbaric invader. I saw the apartments, schools, and hospitals Russians have leveled, and heard how exhausted fighters are having to ration artillery shells. They fire one for every five from Russia. If Johnson met those whose lives and liberties rest in his hands, perhaps he'd be less willing to throw them to the wolves. Nobody should gloss over Trump's stunning words in South Carolina, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. Not long ago, anyone who spoke of backing Russia over NATO and encouraging Putin to brutalize our allies would have been dismissed as a hateful anti-American fanatic. But Trump is the leader of the GOP and seeking a return to the White House, and he's telling us exactly what he'll do if he succeeds: make the U.S. a friend to the Kremlin and an enemy to NATO. Putin knows this, and now so should every American. The controversy of the week. Biden. Will his age cost him the White House? Our 81-year-old president's failing functionality is now a matter of public record, said Hugo Gordon in the Washington Examiner. In an explosive report released last week, Justice Department Special Counsel Robert Hur wrote that Joe Biden had willfully retained classified documents after leaving the vice presidency in 2017. But Hur did not recommend charges. Why? Because 5 hours of interviews with Biden, in which he allegedly struggled to recall when his term as vice president began and ended, and precisely which year his son Beau died, led her to conclude that a jury would exculpate the president for being a well-meaning elderly man with poor memory. Democrats immediately slammed her for painting Biden as a chucklehead, but the special counsel was legally obliged to explain his decision not to prosecute to Attorney General Merrick Garland. At a White House press conference, Biden insisted, "I know what the hell I'm doing," and that he didn't need anyone to remind him when Beau died. Yet in that defiant, combative appearance, Biden also confused the presidents of Egypt and Mexico, said Matthew Continetti in National Review. That mental slip comes just days after he identified the current leaders of France and Germany as the long-dead François Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl. With an ailing Biden in charge, America is in deep trouble. Her smears are straight out of James Comey's playbook, said Robert Kuttner in The American Prospect. Just months before the 2016 election, then FBI Director Comey technically exonerated Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in a report on her handling of classified emails, but he included a gratuitous tongue-lashing of her alleged carelessness that seriously, perhaps fatally, damaged her campaign. Now her, appointed U.S. attorney for Maryland by Donald Trump, has spun up a similar hit job. And mainstream media outlets are eating it up, said Judd Legume in Popular.info, publishing dozens of news pieces and op-eds on her's amateur medical judgments. Meanwhile, Trump's own confusion of people and names has been far worse. He's repeatedly mixed up GOP rival Nikki Haley for Representative Nancy Pelosi, yet received far less coverage. Biden's advanced age is far from ideal for a president seeking a second term, said Margaret Sullivan in her Substack newsletter. Never a gifted public speaker, he sometimes fumbles names and dates, just like many people his age. None of that suggests Biden has looming dementia, as some pundits have suggested. And look at his competition. Trump, 77, has vowed to take down American democracy and has been criminally charged 91 times. Yet we're debating Biden's viability. Voters should consider his age and experience as an asset, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. Biden's deft foreign policy maneuvers and ability to get infrastructure legislation through a divided Congress suggest he's the wisest guy to sit in the Oval Office in decades. That's not in spite of his age. It's because of it. But the damage from HERS report is done, said Jackie Calmes in the Los Angeles Times. And you can't just dismiss the 86% of Americans who say Biden is too old for a second term. This moment calls for show and tell. Biden needs to emerge from his staff-spun cocoon and publicly make his own case for re-election. That means acknowledging his advancing years, but also touting his accomplishments and highlighting his opponent's nonstop lies and threat to democracy. It's the only way to neutralize this ultimately unfixable issue. After all, Biden can't get any younger. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Taylor Swift and the Deep State. After the Kansas City Chiefs' dramatic 25-22 overtime victory over the San Francisco 49ers in Super Bowl 58 drew 123.7 million viewers, making it the most watched program in U.S. television history. It was a good week for mutants. After a new study found that wolves within Ukraine's Chernobyl exclusion zone, the irradiated area surrounding the nuclear power station that melted down in 1986, appear to have developed genetic resistance against certain canine cancers. And it was a good week for Mount Everest. After local Nepalese authorities passed a new rule requiring climbers to remove their own excrement in designated poo bags, which will be checked on the climber's return to ensure they haven't left waste on the mountain. But it was a bad week for dynasties. After presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. apologized to family members upset by a Super Bowl campaign ad that mimicked a John F. Kennedy spot from 1960. Kennedy blamed an outside group for creating the $7 million ad, which as of press time remained pinned to the top of his timeline on X. It's a bad week for juvenilia after a Canadian high school art teacher was accused of selling his students' pictures on his personal site without their permission. Mario Perron advertised the creepy portraits for $90 apiece. Finally, it was a bad week for excess baggage after European airline Finnair started weighing passengers at the departure gate for the purpose of aircraft balance and performance calculations. Finnair stressed that compliance with the new scheme is, for now, voluntary. Thank you. The briefing this week is titled, The Great Moon Race. 52 years after the last moon landing, countries and companies are rushing back to the lunar surface. Are many lunar missions in the works? The moon has been relatively quiet since NASA last put a manned spacecraft on the lunar surface in 1972. But our nearest neighbor is now experiencing a flurry of activity, with numerous nations launching and planning missions to analyze its surface, search for ice, and otherwise explore. The U.S. kicked off its new lunar program in November 2022 with the blast-off of Artemis 1, which sent an unmanned Orion crew capsule around the moon. NASA aims to return astronauts to the moon in 2026 and eventually create a permanent lunar base camp at the possibly ice-rich South Pole. India last year became the first country to land a spacecraft in the southern polar region and the fourth nation, after the Soviet Union, the U.S., and China, to reach the moon. Japan became the fifth last month. But the U.S.'s main lunar competitor is China. It has sent rovers to the moon three times since 2013, made the first landing on its far side in 2019, and aims to put boots on the lunar surface by 2030 and to build a base there soon after. Beijing wants to be the space power of the 21st century, a U.S. intelligence official told the Miami Herald, the way we were in the 20th. Globally, more than 100 lunar missions are planned by 2030, many of which will be conducted by private companies. Have any private missions touched down yet? Two private ventures have tried and failed. Tokyo-based iSpace attempted the first private moon landing in April 2023, but its craft ran out of fuel and smashed into the surface. Pittsburgh-based Astrobotic last month launched its 6-foot-tall Peregrine lander, which among its payloads was carrying NASA science experiments and many rovers from the Mexican Space Agency. A fuel leak doomed the craft, which burned up over the Pacific. Next up is Houston-based Intuitive Machines, which will attempt to land its Volkswagen Beetle-sized Nova C lander in the South Polar region later this month. Dozens of other private missions are in development, including the November launch of a SpaceX rocket that will carry Viper, NASA's golf cart-sized water-hunting rover, to the South Pole in an Astrobotic-built lander. Many of those efforts stem from a public-private partnership created by NASA in 2018 to cut costs and accelerate mission development. The agency so far has signed contracts worth $2.6 billion with 14 companies to send up spacecraft carrying NASA projects, as well as payloads from other countries and companies. Firms are also contracting to design spacesuits, create rovers, and build lunar solar farms and nuclear power systems. Why all the interest in the moon? Because it's a step toward reaching deeper into space. If humans can build the infrastructure needed to survive in such an inhospitable environment, where astronauts will be bombarded with 200 times more radiation than on Earth, and temperatures can drop to minus 410 degrees Fahrenheit in deep craters, they will be better equipped to live on Mars, where conditions are even more hostile. The moon is the proving ground, but Mars is the destination. Then NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said in 2019, identifying and extracting ice will be key to sustaining human colonies on the moon. That ice could also be refined into liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, the components of rocket fuel, making the moon a potential refueling stop for deep space missions. And there are other valuable resources on our rocky neighbor. What else is up there? Research suggests the moon holds large amounts of rare earth metals used in electronic components and radiation shielding, as well as aluminum, titanium, and helium-3, a potential fuel for nuclear fusion. Moonbound companies and national governments are interested not just in prestige and exploration, but also in potential profit. This is a quest for treasure, said John Logsdon, founder of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. Who has rights to those resources? There's no global consensus on that. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty, signed by the U.S. and more than 100 other countries, says all countries are free to explore the moon and that none can claim sovereignty. But a 2015 U.S. law gives American citizens the right to possess, own, transport, use, and sell resources pulled from the moon. More than 30 nations have signed the U.S.-drafted Artemis Accords, a non-binding framework that calls on nations to share scientific data and allows countries or companies to create safety zones for extracting mined resources, specifying that such activity does not violate the 1967 treaty. But neither China nor Russia is a party to the deal, and there are concerns that tensions could rise as the U.S. and China compete for lunar supremacy. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson said that if China establishes a foothold first, it is not beyond the realm of possibility that they say, keep out, we're here, this is our territory. Are there other concerns? There are worries about how various lunar efforts might be coordinated. Extraction efforts, for instance, might clash with research operations and despoil a virgin landscape that could offer insights into our solar system. Private landers will bring with them not just scientific instruments, but artworks, time capsules, and other artifacts to set on the moon permanently. Some experts say concerns about international competition for resources are overblown, given the slow pace at which expeditions are likely to unfold. But others say the time for careful consideration is at hand. This is happening now, said science writer Rebecca Boyle, author of the book Our Moon, and there is really no roadmap. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. How leftists could help Trump win. Democrats are focused on the wrong third-party threat to President Biden, said Jonathan Martin. The collective Democratic fixation on the possibility of a centrist candidate from the No Labels organization increasingly looks misplaced. The real threat to Biden's re-election is coming from the left. Anti-vaxxer Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Green Party's Jill Stein, and black activist Cornel West would combine to drain far more votes from Biden than from Trump. The November election is likely to be decided by very narrow margins in swing states, and leftist spoilers could ruin it for Democrats, as they did in 2000 and 2016. Young leftists are particularly alienated by Biden's support for Israel in its war to eradicate Hamas, which they view as a genocide. These voters, who largely get their news from social media, don't realize Biden has been pushing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu behind the scenes for a ceasefire deal, hostage exchange, and humane treatment of Palestinians. Ending the killing would pay enormous political dividends for Biden, but it's far from guaranteed. Democrats will need to enlist young progressives to explain to peers tempted by a third-party hopeful that not voting for Biden ensures Trump's election. Fringe beliefs are now mainstream. The QAnon movement is fading away, said Molly Olmsted, but its extreme right-wing conspiracy theories have gone mainstream. Even Republican elected officials now voice beliefs once considered fringe. The deep state is pulling the strings. Elections are stolen by massive voter fraud. Democrats are replacing white Christians with brown immigrants. And violence and strongman leadership may be necessary to save America. A deranged Pennsylvania man recently voiced these views after killing and decapitating his father, whom he described as a federal employee taking part in the government's treason. The killer, Justin Mon, complained he was the victim of discrimination as a white man and called on patriots and militia members to take the country back from the communist globalist takeover of America by the LGBTQ community, immigrants, and the Black Lives Matter movement. Sound familiar? These are all ideas espoused by Donald Trump and his MAGA followers. Not surprisingly, right-wing media depicted Mon as a nut in the grips of QAnon. But he never once mentioned that deluded group, which is no longer very active. In the Trump era, unhinged conspiracy theories have become standard Republican beliefs. This column comes from South Africa. A tradition of demonizing other Africans. It's election year, time for politicians to once again stir up Afrophobia, said Kenneth McGauthy. African immigrants who come to this country to work are not responsible for South Africa's high crime and unemployment rates, but that propaganda is being spread by the politicians who are running the country into the ground. The foreigners make an easy scapegoat for our lazy and corrupt politicians who are eager to give voters someone to resent besides their elected leaders. Such xenophobic rhetoric has incited violence many times in the past, notably in 2008, when 62 people were killed in anti-immigrant riots in Johannesburg, and in 2019, when a mob targeting Nigerians killed 12 people and looted dozens of businesses. Now it is happening again. Last month, in the town of Zirust, a dozen children of Congolese migrants were hounded out of school because the local residents did not want to share educational facilities with the Congolese community. These Congolese families, like those from many other African countries, fled fighting in their native land decades ago. They have made a new home here. Their children were born here. How sad that they are being rejected in what was supposed to be Nelson Mandela's Rainbow Nation. And it's time for the last word, our feature article. Title this week, Fitting In. Teen girls have long been judged and shamed for being overweight, said Lisa Miller in the New York Magazine. For some, new obesity treatments offer a way to remake their lives. People have had opinions about Maggie Irvey's body ever since she was a baby. Maggie, who is 15 years old, has lived her whole life in Marceline, Missouri, a town of just more than 2,000 people, 97 miles northeast of Kansas City, reached by driving straight highways that traverse wide cornfields lined by white fences, past sale lots full of shiny blue tractors. When Maggie was still in diapers, a relative leaning over her changing table made a comment to her mother, Erica, about how her cha-cha was chubby. And when she was in preschool, the playground chaperone would regularly send Erica photos of Maggie's behind, on the jungle gym, on the merry-go-round, because her jeans, wide at the waist to accommodate her belly, would slip down her hips when she played. When Maggie graduated from kindergarten, her pink ceremonial gown wouldn't zip up all the way, so the teacher had all the children attend graduation with their gowns open. By elementary school, she had settled on a uniform of leggings and tunics. Over time, people began to direct their opinions toward Maggie herself, as on the day in fifth grade when everyone had to come to school wearing clothes that represented the Kansas City Chiefs. Maggie, with nothing suitable in her closet, settled on her father's XXL Chiefs t-shirt. It seemed good enough until one of her friends pointed out loudly that Maggie was wearing her father's clothes to school, and Maggie, who is usually good-natured, came home crying. There were other times, as when a group of girls would see Maggie go back for seconds in the cafeteria and remark, "I'm so full, I couldn't eat one more bite. I don't know how you could eat all that." But Maggie thought the lunch at school was delicious. She and the cook had a bond. Maggie loved to eat, and the cook, gratified, loved to give her more food. In Missouri, at the edge of the Corn Belt and one of the leading beef-producing states in the nation, nearly 37% of adults are obese, slightly below the national rate. And in Marceline, weight loss is a way of life. At least 8 of the Irvies' friends or acquaintances have undergone bariatric surgery, and Erica can name a dozen people who are on Plexus, a system of powder supplements and creams that supposedly promote muscle mass and gut biome health. There are many larger children at Maggie's high school, but even so, thinness conveys rank in the pecking order. So when, in eighth grade, Maggie's body began to shrink, the town in general approved. When she was 13, her doctor had prescribed Victoza, a GLP-1 agonist that was an early predecessor of Ozempic and Wegovy. 6 months later, when Maggie underwent bariatric surgery, she had already become noticeably thinner. The following year, when Maggie joined her mother at the town pool for water aerobics, the older women there would compliment Maggie on her appearance and her new two-piece bathing suit with the strawberry pattern, saying, "Ah, Maggie, look at your bikini. I just love it on you. You look so adorable." And when Maggie switched from the Catholic school to the public high school and joined the cheerleading squad, people began approaching her parents in the bleachers at games, commenting on how pretty she'd become. "She's always been pretty," her father, Brett, would respond, and the people would backpedal and agree. By January 2023, when she turned 15, Maggie had lost more than 80 pounds and grown 3 inches. That month, the American Academy of Pediatrics released new clinical obesity treatment guidelines recommending that pediatricians steer their patients along the path she had forged. Consider bariatric surgery and medication as early as possible. The guidelines created a public furor. These GLP-1 agonists were new, and their long-term effects on children's minds and bodies entirely unknown. Maggie, then in her first year of high school, was unaware of her connection to any of this. She had no self-conception as a pioneer, among the first handful of children to seek out this new class of drugs to control their weight. She had more pressing concerns, such as making new friends and trying to feel comfortable in jeans after a lifetime of leggings. But if Maggie was sheltered from the onslaught beyond her small town, her mother was not. Erica had also struggled with her weight her entire life and feels the experience defined her. She has done everything she can to reassure Maggie that she is beautiful as she is and to protect her from the casual cruelty of people she encounters. But she also knew from the time her daughter was young that there was something different about her. In a small, dark part of herself, Erica feared that, because of her parenting or her habits or her own history with food, she was the one at fault. The first time Maggie entered the Childhood Obesity Clinic at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City in October 2019, she was 11 years old and weighed about 250 pounds. Maggie's liver function tests were slightly elevated, and her insulin levels were high but not alarmingly so. When the doctor took Maggie's medical history, Erica said her daughter had been insatiable as long as she could remember. She used that word, insatiable. Erica remembers Maggie perched in her high chair in the kitchen at about 2 years old with her grandfather, who was cutting her meat. With her back turned, Erica heard Papa laughing. "She's eating the whole pork steak," he said. After dinner, Maggie would often go to the stove and eat the leftovers out of the casserole pan. For 2 summers, starting when Maggie was 8, the Irvies decided to send her to Camp Jumpstart. The prevention gospel then was calories in, calories out, a principle established after the Industrial Revolution when doctors liked to compare the human body to the latest technology, the steam engine. At Camp Jumpstart, the kids exercised all day on a minimalist diet. After her first 2 weeks, Maggie called her mother and begged to come home, but the camp director advised against it. She said, "If you come and pick her up now, she's going to weigh 500 pounds when she's 15, and she won't live to adulthood," Erica said. "I wanted to die inside." In the 2010s, as family doctors and school nurses across the country were instructing larger children to eat less and exercise more, clinicians and scientists who specialized in obesity were beginning to understand the phenomenon in a different way. They knew from seeing kids in the clinic that some of them couldn't lose weight or maintain weight loss no matter how hard they tried. It was, to a large degree, the study of post-bariatric patients that led doctors to see obesity not as a matter of simple arithmetic, but as a pathophysiological disorder of the signals among the body's gut, organs, hormones, fat tissue, and brain. Maggie's obesity was categorized as severe, making her eligible for the most intensive treatments. Maggie started taking Victoza before her bariatric surgery, then restarted after the surgery didn't lead to the dramatic weight loss everyone had hoped for. With the combination, she began shedding pounds. Brooke Sweeney, the medical director of the Childhood Obesity Clinic and the psychologist on staff at Children's Mercy, had many conversations with Maggie about her goals and expectations. They didn't talk about weight or BMI. In fact, when Maggie gets weighed at Children's Mercy, the number on the scale is covered. What the doctors were asking was whether she had an image in her head of what kind of life she wanted to live and what she wanted her body to be able to do for her. Maggie, then 12, had a hard time answering this question. As a child, she had loved the Disney Princess Rapunzel, but as she grew older, she switched her alliance to Moana because, though the former princess represented liberation from confinement, the latter had more of a social conscience. She loved Taylor Swift, and she liked Rihanna says whatever she wants. But she didn't want to be like any of them, not really. What she said was, "I want to look like Jessica," not her real name, a thin, popular girl in her grade. The doctors urged her to think differently, to imagine a self that was Maggie, not Jessica. "That's not a goal," they told her. "To look like somebody else can't be your goal." Maggie said she understood, but in the long car rides back to Marceline, she would ask her mother, "Why couldn't she look like Jessica? Is it bad to want to look like Jessica?" On the Wednesday after Halloween, about 2.5 years after Maggie began taking Victoza, Erica and I went to watch cheerleading practice. We sat on a cushioned bench on a low tier of bleachers lining a basketball court. 9 girls attended practice that day, all in white t-shirts and short black gym shorts. A stiff white and yellow bow perched on their heads. They started with a round of stretches, hurdlers, lunges, splits. In unison, they counted off reps and low, booming grunts that echoed off the walls of the high school gym. Erica believes the medication and surgery gave Maggie an opportunity to remake her life early before she goes to college and makes the friends who will sustain her adulthood. Maggie had always been a happy and resilient child, mostly insulting the bullies back rather than taking what they said to heart. In middle school, Erica saw her daughter starting to crumble, and she feared that too much of that sadness would take a toll. I don't think she would have had the same personality if she had continued to be as big, Erica says. But now Maggie has a new identity as a child, so determined to become thinner that she changed her life and endured years and years of treatment, and will endure many more. Erica worries about that too. I'm like, did I project all this? Did I? It ended up being a bigger deal than I ever wanted it to be. When Maggie joined the cheerleading team at the beginning of her sophomore year, she gained access to a group of older girls who hadn't known her before. She is able to move among them as herself, not as a person who went through a radical physical change. The older girls say hi to her in the halls, and they talk to her in study hall and weightlifting class. She sometimes receives DMs from other larger girls at school asking who her doctor was or how she became so thin. And she answers them because they don't acknowledge one another in the halls. What Maggie didn't like about her life before, she told me, was that she stood out when she wanted to blend in. So much of her present happiness is related to the feeling of being finally treated as a normal teenager, a girl who can wear jeans and spend her babysitting money on cutoffs. She can go shopping at an actual store for a dress to wear to the homecoming dance. In her bedroom, she takes the dress out of the closet. Hot pink and silky. It is the fanciest thing she has ever worn. A friend's mom did her makeup and nails and took a photo that Erica posted on Facebook. In it, seven girls, all with curled hair and bright body-hugging dresses, are turned sideways to the camera. These days, Maggie is messaging with boys on Snapchat, and the older girls are inviting her to parties, all of which makes Maggie newly alluring to the friends who excluded her in middle school. Maggie has mixed feelings about this. She doesn't hold grudges. She lives in a tiny town and has a deep loyalty to that, to the intimacy bred by generational roots and long proximity. So when the middle school friends ask her to hang out, she goes, partly because of her history with them and partly out of allegiance to her old self. Recently, a senior invited Maggie to a party. Her brother drove her, and within 45 minutes, they were home again. Upon arriving, the older kids gave her alcohol, which she drank quickly and instantly vomited up. Sweeney had cautioned her about this early on. Bariatric surgery makes people extremely sensitive to alcohol, but that warning had not registered when Maggie was 13. The alcohol was mentioned at Maggie's six-month checkup in November. Sweeney reiterated the message with more emphasis this time. Not only does alcohol have a stronger effect on bariatric patients, but in adults there's a higher risk of abuse. Be careful with your body, she told Maggie. Yours is a very sensitive body. Be cautious, my friend. This was adapted from a story first published in New York Magazine. Read one of the obituaries this week. The working man who ruled the country charts. Toby Keith, 1961-2024. True to his roots, Toby Keith always made sure he didn't get above his raisin. The burly former roughneck proudly called himself Oilfield Trash, even though his sales figures put him in rarefied company. After landing the biggest country radio smash of the 1990s with Shoulda Been a Cowboy, he had a streak of 20 number one hits that made him one of country's biggest stars, selling over 40 million albums. Keith's songs encompass macho swagger, deft wordplay, wry humor, and odes to boozy good times, including Get My Drink On and Red Solo Cup, a country rap tribute to the plastic party cup that broke through to the pop top 20 in 2011. After 9/11, he lashed out with the jingoistic Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, The Angry American, which warned America's enemies, "We'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way." Derided by liberal critics, Keith was unbowed. "The secret in this business," he said, "is to make enough people hate you, is to hate you enough to get them to talk about you." Toby Keith Covell was born in Clinton, Oklahoma, where his father was an oil rigger, said the Oklahoman. A Merle Haggard fan with a gift for songwriting, he worked as a rodeo hand during high school and nearby oil fields after graduation. When the oil market crashed, he played semi-pro football, then worked the roadhouse circuit for years, singing at honky-tonks in Oklahoma and Texas. Eventually, his path took him to Nashville, said NBCNews.com, where he drew the interest of Harold Shedd, a producer who'd worked with Alabama and Shania Twain. Keith put out a self-titled debut that yielded 4 top 10 hits and made him a star at age 32. As the hits continued in the following decades, Keith branched out into business ventures, including a record label, restaurant chain, and a liquor brand, said the Washington Post. A 2013 Forbes cover dubbed him country's $500 million man. Keith, who died of stomach cancer, was often pegged as a reactionary conservative. But he said that while he performed at Donald Trump's 2017 inauguration, he'd also played for Barack Obama and was registered as an independent. "It doesn't matter which one you play for, you're going to get flack," he said in 2017. "Most people don't want to go because they don't want the flack. And I'd take it as an honor." And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page. I think we could get a couple of articles today. Tucker Carlson promoting Putin's propaganda. Russian President Vladimir Putin was waiting for the right stooge, said Margaret Sullivan in The Guardian, when he agreed to an interview last week with former Fox News host Tucker Carlson at the Kremlin. He got just that. The videotaped 2-hour interview posted on X, formerly Twitter, was a priceless propaganda gift, both in Russia and the U.S. It featured softball questions from the smarmy Carlson and a long Putin lecture on the history of the region, which portrayed Ukraine as an artificial state that rightly belongs to Russia. Putin said that if the U.S. would just cut off arms shipments to Ukraine, he was ready for a dialogue about peace, while making it clear Russia will insist on keeping the 20% of Ukraine it's stolen. Putin's allies later admitted that the strongman gave an interview to the avidly pro-Russia Carlson to persuade Republicans to block military aid to Ukraine and to help Donald Trump win the 2024 election. "Trump and Putin will quickly agree on peace in Ukraine," said pro-Kremlin political analyst Sergei Markov, "and the war will be over." The interview did have some news value, said Jimmy Quinn in National Review. Carlson pushed Putin to discuss Russia's unjust detention of Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gurchevich, and Putin implied he'd trade Gurchevich for a Russian assassin imprisoned in Germany. Unfortunately, Carlson didn't take a similarly dogged approach to anything else, failing to ask Putin about Russia's slaughter of Ukrainian civilians or to challenge his litany of false historical claims. All in all, this was a missed opportunity. "Not for Putin," said Peter Baker in the New York Times. Carlson and ex-owner Elon Musk gave the accused war criminal and ruthless autocrat a platform to justify his brutal invasion, which has killed and wounded hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians. "It was a vivid illustration of the head-spinning transformation of Republican views on Russia since the rise of Donald Trump, whose affinity for Putin has not been fully explained, but remains pronounced. Thanks to Trump's influence, Republicans are well down the path of handing Putin a historic victory by cutting off weapons shipments to Ukraine, said Mona Shirin in the Bulwark. If Carlson's ring-kissing visit at this critical juncture accomplished anything, it was cementing the GOP status as the useful idiots of the 21st century. Border. Can Biden slow the migrant surge? After Republicans killed a bipartisan Senate border bill last week, they insisted President Biden could curb illegal immigration through executive action, said John B. Judas in the New York Times. For the sake of the country and his electoral chances, Biden should start using those powers. The 1952 Immigration and Nationality Act says the president can suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens if it would be detrimental to U.S. interest. Well, the roughly 2.5 million undocumented migrants who entered the U.S. last year have imposed a tremendous fiscal burden and damaged the U.S.'s image as a nation of enforceable laws. To stem the flood, Biden can require that asylum seekers apply only at official ports of entry, turning back those who cross elsewhere. He can also tighten rules on who can apply for asylum and end the liberal use of so-called parole to admit whole of classes of people from Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and elsewhere. Our overwhelmed nation needs these fixes now, and they could help Biden and the Democrats in November. Biden has vowed to make Republicans pay politically for torpedoing the border deal, said Jennifer Habercorn and Sam Stein in Politico. Long on defensive over the migrant crisis, he's now blasting his likely election opponent, Donald Trump, for masterminding the bill's demise so he can keep the border as an active campaign issue. But it may be an uphill battle. In a new ABC News Ipsos poll, 49% blamed Biden for the bill's failure, and only 39% blamed Trump. Biden is reaping what he sowed, said Jeremiah Poff in the Washington Examiner. He spent 3 years unwinding Trump-era rules to appease his left-wing base's desire for open borders. With an election looming, he's now trying to dodge blame for the catastrophic results. But voters know better. The most explosive immigration clash of all may still be ahead, said Ronald Brownstein in The Atlantic. If reelected, Trump is promising a mass deportation campaign. His aide, Stephen Miller, says they're planning large-scale raids to remove up to 10 million invaders. In addition to border agents, they plan to use National Guard troops, potentially pulling them from sympathetic red states and sending them into Democratic-run cities. These plans could produce scenes in American communities unmatched in our history, sowing chaos, fear, and even showdowns between Trump's enforcers and Blue City police. If today's immigration disputes seem fraught, just wait. And a few of the shorter notes. During the 2022-2023 school year, K-12 students recovered about a third of the learning they lost in math during the pandemic and a quarter of learning missed in reading. Achievement in reading has surpassed pre-pandemic levels in only three states, Illinois, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Alabama is the sole state to record improvement in math over 2019. A growing number of migrants are trying to enter the U.S. via its relatively porous northern border with Canada. Northern border officials recorded 191,603 encounters with migrants crossing into the U.S. last year, up 41% from 2022, the majority of whom requested asylum at official ports of entry. But more than 12,000 were apprehended crossing illegally, up 241% from 2022. Most were Mexicans who can fly visa-free to Canada. China is building its renewable energy sector so quickly that its greenhouse gas emissions are expected to peak years earlier than anticipated, possibly as soon as this year. China installed 217 gigawatts of solar power last year, a 55% annual increase, and far above the U.S.'s total installed solar capacity. It also added 76 gigawatts of wind energy, more than the rest of the world combined. At least 37 states mandate active shooter drills in schools, but no states mandate such training for police officers. In a recent survey, about 30% of state and local officials said they received no post-police academy active shooter training. Of those who did, many said they received instruction only once in their careers. On the poll watch, 47% of Americans say they are very satisfied with how their own lives are going, close to the record low recorded in 2011. 31% are somewhat satisfied, while 11% are somewhat dissatisfied, and 9% are very satisfied. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from Zsa Zsa Gabor, quoted in the San Diego Jewish World, who says, "I am a marvelous housekeeper. Every time I leave a man, I keep his house." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.